Hello and welcome to Jaw Law. I'm your host, Joe McGregor from Dallas, Texas, from the law firm of McGregor & Doblad. And today, we are going to talk about the jumpstart practice. If you listen to our 2022 Year in Review pod, which was the latest episode, you heard me talk about the jumpstart practice. And it seems that not everyone knows what a jumpstart practice is, although I think everybody knows it, they just haven't heard it called that, and I've heard it called a couple of different things. But in probably what is one of the most instant reactions that I've ever had, I had two people already ask me, what is a jumpstart practice? Tell me more. So just so that we're clear, a jumpstart practice is just what I'm calling it. It can be called other things. It's not an official term. I don't know of anyone who insists that this is official. Just we're going to call it this because a lot of people call it that. First of all, what is a jumpstart practice? Unfortunately, I don't know that there's a great solid definition for it. And I think that the term jumpstart practice or the other terms that get used, I think that they get applied to a variety of scenarios. If I had to define it, I would say that probably the easiest definition is often a practice where the sales price is lower than an estimated build-out of somewhat of a similar practice. Now, one of the persons who asked me what a jumpstart practice was asked, what's the difference between a jumpstart practice and a practice that's just simply low in price? And probably nothing. It's a matter of the beholder. It's the buyer who considers this a jumpstart practice versus just a low-priced practice. If we're trying to complete the definition, we would probably say a practice that doesn't have enough patient flow or patient revenue to sustain, like it's just not optimal, right? It can't sustain you every single day. You're going to have to go try to get new patients. But like I said, there's actually not a firm definition of what it is. It's really you as the buyer, what do you consider a jumpstart practice to be? The most common scenario is our buyer client thinking, okay, here's a practice. It's in a decent place. It's going. There's something wrong with it. Or it's just small. Maybe the seller was tired. And I want to get in there. I think I can double the revenue and make it the practice that I want. To that end, we generally see the startup practice fall into one of three categories or three circumstances. Number one, that the practice has fallen into some type of devaluation somewhat recently. I would say that most often this is somebody who has scaled back their work. They're perfectly fine. And if you think about somebody who's on the doorstep of retirement and they've operated a relatively small practice, and for the last several years, they just wanted to keep it nice and easy. Well, that practice may only sustain like a $400,000 purchase price. But in that community, it may take you $650 to build out a commensurate office. So in that scenario, you could consider that practice, even though there's nothing wrong with it, you could consider that a jumpstart practice, and you're still going to get the seller to help you in the transition. They're going to have trained staff, probably old equipment, I don't know. But it's not that much different than buying a practice that's double the price, you know, an $800,000 practice, except patient flow and, of course, price. Now, another practice that could have fallen into devaluation is something where something has happened to the seller. And this is maybe a little bit different. We're not talking about somebody died or someone had some kind of disability and they had to scale back. We're talking about something has changed in that person's life. The next category of jumpstart practice would be those practices that never really crossed that valuation threshold. So at no point in time did they exceed a valuation where the purchase price would have been higher than just building out on your own. And those come in a lot of varieties. Sometimes it's just it's not interesting to the practice owner to get it up to a higher threshold. Sometimes they can't get it up to a higher threshold. And but the point is that it's always been a rather low producing practice. And the final category are those practices. It's kind of tough to define this, but basically either never opened or just barely opened. Not a whole lot of difference between the previous category and this one, other than maybe timing. You could have the practice owner fall into some type of bad luck. Maybe they've built out their office and they're still waiting to open, and something happens in their life and they need to sell. They need someone else to take over that space. Maybe it already has equipment. It's built out, has equipment. They just need someone to take over. Probably the more common example that I see is someone who has built out an office. It's fully equipped, but right after starting or right after opening, something has happened in their life and they need to get out of there. It's not that the business has failed yet. It's that something's happened and they need to just get out of here. So maybe that's the differentiation between the previous category and this one. In the previous one, it's more likely to be someone who did try to make this thing work. They just never did. In this category, someone who's not yet even had the opportunity to make this a winner of an office. So now that we know what these jumpstart practices are, it is the case that a lot of people out there think, hey, this is a better alternative than just a pure startup. I think it's pretty obvious why that would be the case, but just to confirm, obviously there's less initial cash outlay. Also, when you do a startup, there's no promise that a single patient is ever going to walk through your door. So at least the jumpstart, or at least most jumpstarts, at least have some patient flow. Maybe they've got a lot, maybe they barely have any, but usually there are some patients involved. And then finally, often at jumpstart practices, there are also staff who may be usable for you. They already know the practice, some of the patients. They're at least a good staff to start working with. Now, the point of this podcast is actually to talk about some of the cons. The first con is cosmetic, or at least potentially cosmetic, in that the older jumpstart practices are that. They are older. There's going to be equipment you don't like. There's going to be a layout that you're not interested in, you're not comfortable with, you think is ugly. It might not be in the part of town you want to be in. There's just less ability for you to craft that practice at the outset that you might otherwise be able to do in a true de novo practice. And that is one of the blessings of a de novo practice. You get to set that thing up exactly the way you want. It's the part of town you want to be in. It is laid out the way you want. It's stocked with the type of equipment you want to work with. It's your vision into play. And a jumpstart practice is someone else's vision that didn't work, and now you're going to take over it, and the benefit is a discount. The considerations you need to take as you're encountering a jumpstart practice as an option are, first of all, you do need to know the business reasons why that is a jumpstart practice to begin with. Do you know why that practice failed or never got off the ground or whatever? Do you know why it's not like a full price practice? Maybe they moved locations. Do you know why they moved locations? Is it because of the landlord? Is it because this part of town is dying or is changing? And I don't know that there are necessarily wrong answers. There can be, but it's important to know the answer. If this is somewhat of an abandoned office, if they left, the tenant left the office, do we know why? And then finally, anytime you get an answer to one of these questions, you've got to take it with a grain of salt. There is a good chance that whoever is getting you into that office, if they're not your representative, someone else, whether it's the seller or the landlord's broker or whatever, you got to take it with a grain of salt, because either they're selling you or they don't know themselves. It could be the case that the seller tried to make that work, never got it off the ground, and they don't know why it never took off. One of the things that we see the most, and what I referenced in the pod last time, was we're seeing a lot of satellite offices or second or third offices or whatever, just additional offices. We see a lot of those in the jumpstart market because it just never panned out for the seller. And do they know why it didn't pan out? We presume that if they would have known what wasn't working, they would have fixed it. So if they tell you what wasn't working, you got to take that with a grain of salt. You don't want to make the same mistake they made. Another consideration you need to take is into the business liabilities. This is kind of a tough one because there should be a separation between them and you. And most of the times, this is going to be a very legal and separated by time. It doesn't always work like that. If you're taking over this practice from a seller, sometimes you're going to take over expenses and you're not going to fully understand the implication. So if they've got a contract with a certain, just some kind of provider, do you know what's entailed? We've received many calls from someone who has taken over a practice from someone and they started making payments on a contract only to open it up and finally find out, hey, I don't need this contract, but it says it's for 10 years. It's just stuff like that. Do you know what type of liabilities come with this practice? The other thing is, even if you know that there is a disconnect and separation from you and the seller, does the public know that? Are you going to get old patients who are going to come in and say, I've got $3,000 on account here? Or are you going to have a vendor say, and by the way, we see this with labs a lot, for whatever reason, this is a lab thing, and they're going to say, you owe us $16,000, and you're going to say, no, that's not me. And they're like, yeah, it is you, buddy, and we're going to file a lawsuit or a claim against you if you don't pay. And yeah, you might get that sorted out because that's somewhat easy to work out. You are going to have to deal with problems like this, or you might have to deal with problems like this. So when you're investigating a jumpstart practice, these are the things you need to try to lock down. The next consideration are liens. And liens are somewhat of a generic term. They have a legal term, but sometimes they mean a tax lien. Sometimes it's a judgment lien. A lot of times it's a mechanics lien. And it's not a mechanic that works on your car. It's somebody who maybe it's a contractor who came to fix your HVAC and the seller didn't pay him and they file a mechanics lien on the practice. Also, UCC, Uniform Commercial Code financing statements. We see this a lot on the practice. You need to know who has a claim on that equipment. There is a very good chance that if the seller's not in a great financial position, other people have a better claim on that equipment than you do, even if you pay money for it. The next consideration is kind of following on that, which is tax liability. Probably is not a surprise to learn that the government doesn't really care about your story and about when you took over. They just know that someone at that address owes them some taxes and you better pay or they're going to come and shut you down. You need to know what is owed and what you are going to have to do to make sure that there's a break in liability. What makes this tough is that depending on the taxing authority, it's really hard to find this information out and sometimes is not given out. A lot of times it's because the information hasn't gotten public by that point. And finally, there are just a few random things you need to think about or at least know about. First of all, you need to know that the calculation changes if there are patients involved or not. Sometimes a jumpstart practice is a fully equipped office that doesn't have any patients to sell you. That is a different set of considerations than someone who is selling you a fully equipped office with 100 patients, because now the rules and the laws that apply to patients apply to you if there are any patients. And it's not a big difference, but your paperwork needs to reflect it, and you need to make sure you're following all the state rules that go with that. Furthermore, one of the more problematic issues with that are other entities who may claim ownership over parts of the patient profile. For instance, let's say it's an all-digital office and your patient records aren't on the cloud, they're on a server in the back. A bank may claim that they own that server. They're not claiming that they own the patients. They're just claiming that that server is theirs and they are going to come take it from you. You need to make sure you're not going to deal with something like that. This next one is something we've already kind of talked about, but you need to know who owns that equipment. Seems obvious, but I swear we deal with this several times a year. There are going to be other people who claim they own equipment. There are going to be financing companies who claim that you owe them the money, not the seller. And sometimes you're going to get surprised when you walk in that door and then you get a letter and you find out something you thought the seller owned was actually being leased from a third party. Another issue is, and this is going to be something that is probably going to apply more to older spaces and older parts of town, but it is the case that especially in growing communities that the code changes. I'm going to make something up. Let's just say the city code for the doorway changes. It now needs to be X inches wide rather than what it used to be. And what they'll often say is that if you already have a door that is X inches wide, don't worry about it. You're not going to have to refit it. But if you ever cease being the owner, the new person has to get in there and fix the door. So you may have trouble getting a new certificate of occupancy because your practice isn't up to code, even though the seller was up to code. The point is, you just might not be grandfathered. Another consideration is valuation on these types of practices is tough. It's kind of weird, but it seems to be the case that as the practice gets cheaper and cheaper, it gets harder and harder to value. And as most of you know, a component of valuation, or at least a component of the purchase price, is what we call an asset allocation, where we are assigning some of the purchase price to the hard assets and some of the purchase price to the personal goodwill of the seller. In a jumpstart practice, if you're buying a practice for $250,000, traditionally we would have goodwill be about 80%. But that may not work if the equipment is worth $200,000. So we see a lot of sellers try to wedge that 80% goodwill into a concept like this, and it's just not appropriate. Sometimes it is, but you need to think about the allocation and just acknowledge that it might be different. The final consideration is that financing might be difficult. There are probably going to be fewer banks interested in making this loan for you. And when they do make this loan, they're going to use different calculations, basically give you this money under a different set of considerations than if this was a $1 million practice. And that's not necessarily problematic. It's just different. That loan might look different. And you might have fewer banks to shop around this project for you. I want to talk in closing about what we have seen in the jumpstart market scenario. Unfortunately, this isn't going to be very helpful, but I would say that in general, it's not a rule, in general, it is probably more challenging to bring that practice up than people realize. As soon as I say that, though, I know there are people out there who take that $300,000 practice and 5 years later, it's a $2 million practice. I get that. I know that that happens. We've seen that with our own clients. That exact scenario has actually played out for us. The point is that it might be more challenging than you realize. That's why I say when you go in there, you need to know why the seller was unsuccessful, because it might be the same story for you. Now, I don't want anyone to read into that too much. I just don't want anyone to think that that's a rule. I think that there are so many factors that go into this that you can't draw too many conclusions. At the same time, I owe it to you to tell you, we have seen repeated situations where someone buys a jumpstart practice and ends up 6 years later selling a jumpstart practice. Maybe they've improved it. Maybe they've made money along the way, but there you go. And that's all we have for today. I hope this was helpful to somebody. If you have questions, please give us a call or shoot me an email, jmcgregor@mcgregorfirm.com. We would love to help you out. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you next time.